It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Bitcoin values have soared and shot up and down in recent weeks. We learn more about the risks and rewards of cryptocurrency and what it is with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal. First, Republican Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is walking back some of the comments he made implying that there was a strong anti-Trump bias among some members of the FBI. He went so far as to say there's corruption at the highest level and a secret society in the agency meeting outside of government offices. At the center of the issue were text messages that went missing from members of the FBI that were made public later. His remarks have gotten a lot of attention nationally. Daniel Bice has been covering the story. He's the watchdog columnist at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's give a listen to some of these comments first made on Fox News Special Report with Brett Baer. Here's a listen.
So what this is all about is further evidence of corruption, more than bias, but corruption at the highest levels of the FBI and that secret society. We have an informant that's talking about a group that were holding secret meetings off-site. There's so much smoke here. There's so much suspicion.
Let's stop there. A secret society, secret meetings off-site of the Justice Department.
Correct.
And you have an informant saying that?
Yes.
Is there anything more about that?
No, we have to dig into it. This is not a distraction. Again, this is bias, potentially corruption at the highest levels of the FBI.
So this is a pretty strong statement, Dan. What was some of the reaction to this comment from Senator Johnson?
It was pretty uniformly negative. You had Democrats such as Chuck Schumer, who said it appeared delusional and paranoid, but actually the pushback on the right was more interesting. You had a number of conservatives, Eric Erickson, who's a radio guy and a conservative blogger, attack him, saying that he should be ashamed of himself. You also had Joe Scarborough from MSNBC, who described him, said his comments were a reckless slur against the FBI from a pathetic lackey of Trump. So pretty harsh stuff.
And looking at the text, the word secret society does appear in one of these texts from one FBI agent to another. What have we heard about the backstory behind that, though?
It appears that it's just a joke. One of the people in this email exchange had bought calendars of pictures of Vladimir Putin in these beefcake poses, and he was going to give them to everybody working on the FBI's Russia probe. And then after the election, someone else sent him a note that said, basically, what are you going to do with your calendars? Maybe we should keep them for our first secret society meeting. And so... So Republicans have run with that, but it very clearly looks like it was intended, that it was all said in jest. And even Ron Johnson has acknowledged that that's clearly possible. He told me yesterday it certainly could be the case that this was all just a joke. But he continues to push one issue, which is that he has an informant, a whistleblower, who's talked to his committee, who says, and they don't use the word secret society now, but who knows about off-site meetings by FBI agents. And he even yesterday was standing by that, saying that is true. That's led Senator Claire McCaskill, who's also on his committee, to ask for the name of this person and any details, because she's not seen anything about this.
And this is part of Republicans in Congress, some of them criticizing the FBI over what they see as bias in the probe of the Russian interference in the election and President Trump's then campaign, but also their handling of Hillary Clinton's emails and private server issues, right?
Right. And it's, the context is important. When you do have an aggressive investigator, it's not unusual for those affiliated with those under investigation or the people being investigated to attack the prosecutor. People here in Wisconsin should be very familiar with this. In the John Doe investigation, conservatives came out very hard and pushed very hard during John Doe 2 to try to undermine John Chisholm. And even before that, you had the Clintons trying to undermine Ken Starr for his investigation in the 90s of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So this is something that the Republicans are trying to do, but they don't yet have the information to do that. And this was Ron Johnson jumping ahead of himself and saying that he had this, you know, he did change his statement from the clip you played. He's now saying potential that there's a potential scandal in the department. So he's pulled it back somewhat, but he also still wants to hang on to certain details of what he's saying.
Talking to Daniel Bice from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the reaction to comments by Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator, looking at the FBI and their handling of a couple of investigations of Hillary Clinton's email server and the Russia probe. Are people still talking about those initial comments? Has he walked it back enough to where people are kind of letting it go, do you think, Dan?
I think it was just a very bad week for him. Ron Johnson is very much his own person. He will say things that you don't expect, like when he talked about the global warming was due to sunspots, or when he, jumped in and attacked the Lego movie. Those things have had, minor damage to him. But during the last campaign, it actually helped him when he was his own person, because he was running against Russ Feingold. And with about a month and a half to go, he fired all of his consultants, and he decided to do the election on his own terms. And in one instance, he was very candid where he said that he personally did not respect or like Russ Feingold, and I'm sure his campaign staff hated it. But there's a certain authenticity to what he's saying, but at the same time, you have to wonder what he's thinking when he says stuff like this.
And this comes in a week where we're hearing reports from the New York Times that President Trump at one point had given an order to fire Robert Mueller. His legal counsel declined to do that, threatened to quit, according to this New York Times report, which the president denies. These comments from Senator Johnson are coming at yet another pretty hot week in this investigation.
Yeah. So, as I said, the context is important. You have to realize that Republicans are trying to do whatever they can to undermine the special prosecutor, as well as trying to undermine the FBI. Another thing to remember is that Ron Johnson is chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. That committee has it can cover a lot of issues, and that's how he's able to put himself in the middle of some of these scandals or these investigations, because he says he's the one in charge of records issues, and he's also in charge of whistleblowers. So if a whistleblower wants to come forward, they would come to his committee.
And what are you looking for as Senator Johnson works on that committee and this investigation? This is one of three, basically, investigations going on in the Senate, the House, and, of course, Robert Mueller. There's a lot going on.
All right. Well, yeah, and you mentioned the Clinton email, and Ron Johnson's still looking at that. But it's not so much the Clinton emails that they're interested in. They're interested in Comey and why he didn't charge Hillary Clinton. So they're trying to focus again on the FBI and their handling situation, and to suggest that maybe there was some bias in their handling of the Hillary Clinton case, and there's bias now in the handling of the Donald Trump case. This is not just an innocent look at a particular issue. It's an attempt to undermine the prosecutors in the Trump investigation.
Senator Johnson doesn't have re-election to worry about for, 4 years now? So this is something that we may not remember come time for if he seeks re-election even in 4 years.
Well, he's already said he's not running for re-election. So I think what we can expect are more comments like this from Ron Johnson. He doesn't have to worry about running for office again. I don't see him changing his mind. But as you said, even if he does, that's some time from now. It's funny. He didn't apologize. He was asked if he was sorry they used the phrase secret society in his comments to Brett Baer on Fox News, and he refused to apologize and started saying he used this term only because it was used by officials at the FBI. He's not someone to walk. He's walked it back, but not to the point where he says he's sorry or that he would have done anything differently.
A lot to watch. Dan, as always, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for the invitation.
That's Daniel Bice, watchdog columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joins today to talk about comments Senator Ron Johnson made about anti-Trump bias in the FBI, as he saw it. Back in 2013, one Bitcoin was worth $120. Now it's worth over $10,000, with some investors saying they've made millions from the currency. But the cryptocurrency has been associated with some shady business at times, and some experts warn it's a bubble that could be about to burst. So is it all it's cracked up to be? And should you be investing, or do you wish you had some years back? Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with Paul Vigna earlier this week. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and the author of several books about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
Before we really dig in, can you explain the idea behind Bitcoin for us?
In broad terms, the idea is to have a digital version of cash, something that people can use to exchange value back and forth online that works, you know, it's at least a facsimile of cash. In other words, if you and I are together and I owe you $5 and I hand out I pull a $5 bill out and give it to you, that is a transaction that is handled immediately. Mm-hmm. I hand you a piece of paper and, you know, you have the $5 that I previously had. So the idea of Bitcoin was to kind of do a digital version of that. So it's really just, it's trying to come up with a digital version of cash. The couple of things, and again, I'm trying to keep it sort of broad,
sure,
broad concepts. A couple of things that make it a little bit different are, first off, that the whole network is set up to run on its own. In other words, it's literally a software program. That's what Bitcoin literally is a software program that is run across a network of computers that are linked together, but no one computer is the central depository. There's no one central point of control, and that's very important. The guy who set it up, we don't know exactly what it is. He called himself Satoshi Nakamoto. The person wanted to set up a digital cash, an online currency that could not be controlled by any one person or group of people, no bank, no government. The idea was to just get beyond these sort of systems that we've all grown up with and have all had for our entire lives, and that do work. It's not that they don't work. It's that those systems can be abused, and we have seen them in the past be abused, and all of us saw it in 2008, where you had a system where opacity was the rule, and there was no transparency, and you didn't actually know who was controlling what, and the whole thing kind of fell apart. So the idea was to get away from a network like that. So it's basically online cash that is not controlled by a central party.
So who is using Bitcoin? Who is making those transactions using this instead,
sure,
of more standard currency?
Right. In the early days, it was, and it still is really, a pretty small group of people. Even though the last year there has been a tremendous amount of hype and stories and interest and media interest, and, you know, I've certainly written a bunch of stories on it. Actually, it's all I've been writing, you know, the last 7 or 8 months. So there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of curiosity, but despite that, there's still a relatively small amount of people using it, and there are still relatively few things that you can use it for. Right now, it's primary, I'd say in the last 8 months or so, its primary use has become as a trading vehicle. I mean, people are buying, selling it. They're speculating on it. They're treating it like any other kind of asset in the markets that they think they're going to make a profit off of, and they're doing it on that basis. So now, right now, I'd say most of the people who are using it for trading. And most of the people tend to be, you know, your sort of typical techie, you know, the relatively educated, upscale, younger, probably white guy in San Francisco, a lot of them. But, you know, they're spread around the country and around the world. But it's mainly that sort of, you know, tech crowd with some libertarians sprinkled in there, some anarchists sprinkled in there. In the earlier days, a lot more of the a higher percentage of Bitcoin transactions were for dark web stuff, buying and selling drugs online, ransomware, that kind of stuff. That really has fallen off. I mean, what really has become the dominant thing is trading now. So in addition to all those people I just talked to, you now have a cohort that are literally just traders, investors, mostly retail investors. You know, Wall Street is pecking around in this. They're trying to figure out how exactly they can get involved in it, make some money off it. So that's kind of where it stands right now.
And Paul, one of the questions that I have that I haven't been able to find an answer to is, you said that people invest in it hoping to make money. How is the value set? What is controlling that? What is driving up the value or driving it down? Because we've seen huge swings in the value of a Bitcoin.
It's a free market. I mean, it is. It's interesting. If you like free markets, this is the freest market ever. I mean, there is nobody that controls it. It literally, the value is set by traders, for good or for bad. I mean, there are a lot of people that look at this and say, oh my God, it's at $11,000. That's absolutely insane. And then there are other people saying $11,000, that is a bargain. I'm going out and buying three of them. Mm-hmm. The value of it is set by what somebody is willing to buy it for at that minute. I mean, it really is. That is it.
Now, so it's totally supply and demand. It's what people are willing to pay for it.
Completely supply and demand. The problem is people have a hard time agreeing what the price should be, and people have a hard time agreeing what it even is. I mean, there's still a debate about what Bitcoin even is. Is it a currency? Is it a commodity? Is it an asset? Is it just a store of value? Is it something that we should be using for online transactions? I mean, all these things are still being worked out. And I think a lot of that kind of goes into, it becomes reflected in that extreme volatility that you see.
We're talking with Paul Vigna right now. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and covers Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And we touched just a little there on Wall Street wondering how or whether it should get involved in this. What about traditional banks? That seems like the most kind of logical corresponding institution. How are banks and other forms of payment kind of dealing with this?
Right. Cautiously. I think, you know, for the last couple of years, really, since probably 2015 at least, banks have started to take this seriously, at least as an idea, as a concept, as a technology. There was a while there where they kind of figured, well, you know, Bitcoin is open source software, which just means that rather than a company like Microsoft creating a program and selling it, the person who created this program, the pseudonymous Satoshi Nakamoto, just released it out into the open for anybody to use as they see fit, or to take it and alter it and come up with their own version of it. And for a while, the banks just thought, well, we're just going to take the concepts and build our own. And they've tried that, and they haven't abandoned that, but they've also kind of seen where the price was going, and then they started thinking, well, maybe there's some money to be made at this thing. So they're approaching it on that from that angle as well. But it's not as easy as an individual investor getting in and saying, hey, I think there's some money to be made here. I'm just going to go buy some. Banks have a lot of people that they have to answer to. They have regulators and shareholders and customers, and you know, they have to be a responsible, sober custodian of their customers' money. And so there's a lot of layers for them to go through before they could really get into this and start trading it. So I think that's what you've seen is them trying to figure out, is this safe for us to do? Is this responsible for us to do? You know, and if we make those determinations, how can we do it? And they haven't really gotten to that point yet. I mean, all the banks are looking at it and thinking about it and trying to figure it out, but none of the big banks, I'm talking about the big, like, Wall Street firms, you know, none of them are actively trading it right now. So they're still kind of on the outside looking in. So you do have the infrastructure of Wall Street really starting to take an active interest in this. It's just a matter of how far and deep each, you know, various firms are in it yet.
That would seem to indicate that those institutions see this as the start of something new, not a blip that's just going to kind of fade off on its own. You've been covering this very in depth. What do you think? Is this a wave of the future? Is this going to continue to grow?
I think the ideas behind it are extremely powerful. And I think that it is a technology that can be applied to a lot more than just coming up with an online version of cash to trade. And whether or not Bitcoin itself becomes, you know, something that goes mainstream and becomes part of our daily lives, I think the concepts behind it are powerful. And I think the idea, and you're seeing this in a lot of places, I mean, I think the idea of mobile money is something that in 5 or 10 years will be mainstream, whether we are using Bitcoin or whether we're using Apple Pay or Google Pay or your bank comes up with an online app, an app that's on your phone and you can use it that to make payments, or whether it's, you know, something else. I think the idea of mobile money is really something that absolutely is going to go mainstream and become part of our lives. And this is, I'm not kidding you, this is coming from somebody who has cash in his wallet right now and uses cash as much as possible. I mean, like, as much as I write about this stuff, I'm fairly, pretty much a Luddite when it comes to money. Like, I still like cash. But I do see the future, and I think the future is, you know, we are going to be doing things digitally pretty much almost exclusively. How long that's going to take, I don't know. Will Bitcoin be part of that? I think it will, but again, I don't know. I mean, the thing about Bitcoin, the really fascinating thing about Bitcoin is that this is a live experiment. I mean, this thing was created and launched, and it is taken off virally, and there are a group of people that became very caught up in the idea, and it's a really, really fascinating story, and it's a fascinating thing to watch, but it is absolutely an experiment, and nobody knows where it's going to go.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for spending time with us and helping us get our minds around cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I was happy to. Thanks for having me.
Paul Vigna is a reporter who covers cryptocurrency for the Wall Street Journal. He talked there with Judith Sears-Poisson about the risks and rewards of Bitcoin and whether we want to invest and what it is. It's Food Friday, and this week we're exploring our spice rack. From cardamom to cumin and poppies to peppers, a spice can add a subtle flavor to a dish, or it can be the star of the show. But what spice should we use for a particular dish? What spices work best together, and how much should we use? Our next guest has lots of advice. Mark C. Stevens is the author of Cooking with Spices, 100 recipes for blends, marinades, and sauces from around the world. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You're clearly a big spice fan. How did you get there? What made you fall in love with spices, Mark?
The world travelness of it all, Rob. I've been to all 7 continents, although Antarctica doesn't have very many spices. I've been able to uncover rocks and stones and logs and get a lot of flavors in my mouth from around the world, and it has inspired me to get it out there.
And you write a little bit about the history of spices, and it's pretty amazing. Empires were created in pursuit of spices, trying to find them all over the globe, and now they all come to us. It's a great time to cook.
100%. Never in our history as a species has so many flavors been so available. And we tend to think of things as rare still, but certainly now you can get your hands on almost anything.
And let's get our definition straight here, because the lines are a little blurry for me sometimes. What is a spice versus an herb, or in Salt's case, a mineral?
Yeah, so this is a mistake or miscategorization that goes up to the highest levels of the culinary world, I found, just from speaking to people. And also the definition that comes into my book, because there's no herbs in it. The herb will be the leaf dried or stem dried of a plant. And then the spice is basically anything else. So the rhizome, roots, dried berry, flower, dried flower, and everything there before. And salt, of course, is a mineral, and I fought very hard to include salt in this book because, of course, we use it like a spice in almost everything.
And let's get some general spice basics here. I have, and I was mistaken in this, it turns out, I used to think, okay, salt, spices, they're dry. It doesn't matter really how fresh they are. Wrong?
1,000% wrong. If 1,000 can be a percent, it's wrong. Spices definitely lose their flavor. They surprisingly hold up very, very well when they're whole. There's one way that you can identify a pretty reputable spice dealer is to buy whole spices and then grind them yourself. But once they're ground, you're looking at 6 months to a year maximum for the really like potent flavor that you want to get out of them, that they're going to last.
And talk about care and storage of our spices. How do we keep them good as long as we can?
Oh, man. How much time do we have on this program? Because there's so many things that go into storing spices that can help you preserve them. The biggest thing that surprised me a while back was just don't add your spice over the stove as you're cooking the dish from the jar, because the heat, the things that'll lose the flavor the most, Rob, are heat, sunlight, wetness, and that's why you always want to store them in a dry, cool, dark place like the cabinet away from above the stove. But even if, you know, you're shaking your jar of paprika over your simmering chicken or whatever it is, all that heat and moisture that's coming off the stove is going right into it, can clump it up, make it lose its flavor. So the best thing to do is glass, metal jars, cool, dry place that's dark. And since most of them come, companies try to save money with packaging in plastic, as sort of what I was getting to earlier, transfer them. Get a bunch of metal or glass small jars and just transfer them, and you'll find much more success in your storage.
One big lesson I've gotten here on Food Friday from guests in the past was, in the past, I think I was kind of shy with my spices. I want to use a little here, a little there. Don't want to waste it. And now I have more of an attitude like, use it or lose it. It's only going to be good for so long. Try it. Experiment with it. Is that a better way to tackle my spices?
I think so. I mean, that's sort of the point of this book, is to get you out of your wheelhouse and your comfort zone. Most of us as home cooks, which I am, I'm not a professionally trained cook, but also why I wanted to write the book, is a lot of us use five spices that we're comfortable with. And if we can't pronounce the name of it, or we are uncomfortable with how it's used, maybe we don't use as much of it. However, all these spices have had a relationship that goes back hundreds of years with each other, too. And a lot of them go together. A lot more of them go together than we might imagine. So innovation and getting out of your comfort zone and wheelhouse is absolutely, absolutely encouraged.
We're talking on Food Friday with Mark C. Stevens. His new book is called Cooking with Spices. And Mark, get us out of our comfort zone a little. Give us a couple of spice combos that we might want to experiment with, things that work really well together that might not be at front of mind or at the top of our spice drawer.
Sure. Well, the great synergy, right, is spice and herbs together. They can add a lot of both super strong and subtle flavors, since generally the difference between spices and herbs are, one, the stem, and the rest of the plant. Also, wars have been fought over spices. Very few wars and bloodshed have been fought over herbs. but also they just go so well together. One of my favorite spices that has come out of this book and also my most recent travels is sumac. And sumac, we don't know very much about, but if you go to the Middle East or Germany, anywhere there's a big Turkish population or Maghrebian population, you'll find sumac on kebabs and stuff, and it goes so good with thyme. Like, sumac and thyme are incredible, and they're good for chicken, shrimp stews, even just rice. So that's one of my go-tos if I'm sort of running out of ideas. And they're also two of the three ingredients in a very famous spice blend called za'atar, but that's not something that we normally get into. What else? Let's see. Nutmeg and sage are super good.
Actually, I want to stick with sumac for a second, because that's one of the recipes you shared with us. It's on the WPR.org/Food Friday. It's sumac blackberry agridulce marinade. Tell us about that.
So this is... it's one of my favorites. I've probably made this one more than any other recipe in the book. The blackberries make it very sweet. There's corn syrup in there, and you cook that down, and you come out with this really amazing agrodolce. It's also sort of a gastrique, if you want to get French with it. And it goes so well with so many things, but especially duck, pork chops, things of that nature. You can put it on chicken, or you can just put it on crackers and serve it in a party. And this recipe has a special place in my heart, because I have an Italian grandmother. She's 92, and she's very traditional and cooks very traditionally, and as you can imagine, cooks fantastically. I mean, my childhood with her recipes was filled with culinary delights. But when you tell your Italian grandmother that you're writing a cookbook and it's not about Italian food, there's a lot of suspicion. And what exactly are you doing it with? And I tested a bunch of recipes at her house this summer and just got away off the grid and off the internet for a while just to get through a lot of the research. And this was the first recipe that I made that she tried, and her eyebrow perked up and got the expression in her face that maybe I wasn't going to be a failure, because she actually liked it and admitted as much, which are two very different things for Italian grandmothers. So I really love this sauce. I make it all the time, and it goes well on so many things, and it can also be used as a marinade. And throughout the book, I've tried to make a lot of these recipes useful for more than one thing, and then also tie in to other recipes in the book, so that when you start cooking from it and when you start learning from it, you don't end up in the situation where you've opened a recipe book, you've gone to the store and got the ingredients, you've made that recipe once, and then 3 years later you move and you find those spices that you bought in the back of your cupboard unused since that time you bought them. So there's a lot of sumac recipes in here, and there's a lot of things that can go together. And for instance, on the other page of this one, there's the sumac eggplant paste, and if you make those two things together, those two recipes, and you have two courses, they pair excellently together.
And Mark, it seems like where you're trying to get us is even, I don't need a recipe. I know if I'm going to make chicken this certain way, I know this combination of two, three spices and this other herb that I know I have, that's going to work together. I'm going to have that feel for what I need and how it's going to play together.
Absolutely. You hit it on the head. And these are all good starters, good places to get your gloves on in terms of working with the spices, but ideally you take what you learn from the book and the spice, individual spice profiles in the book, learn what goes together that works for you, and you also add them to your recipes. You've been doing something for 2 or 3 years or something every Friday or once a month, jazz it up with this one easy step that's one step away from what you normally do, and then that opens up the next step and the whole other world, and then you're starting to cook without the recipes and just saying, oh, I'm using this. I know it goes with that, and feeling comfortable doing that.
We're talking to Mark C. Stevens right now. He's the author of Cooking with Spices, 100 Recipes for Blends, Marinades, and Sauces from Around the World. You can join our Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you need a recommendation for a spice to jazz up a favorite dish? Do you have a favorite spice that you want to share with us? Do you need some help figuring out what to do with what's in your spice rack right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes while you're there. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Food Friday. We're talking about spices with Mark C. Stevens. He's the author of Cooking with Spices, 100 Recipes for Blends, Marinades, and Sauces from Around the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice for Mark on what kind of spices to add, something to experiment with, something to maybe add a new wrinkle to a favorite dish of yours? Or do you have a favorite go-to spice or combo of spices that you go back to again and again? Do you feel a little shy about using spices, don't want to overdo it, need somebody to talk you down a little bit? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mark, we got an email from Justin who just wanted to know if it's pronounced paprika or paprika. I go with paprika. I love it. I think you do too, Mark, and it makes a lot of appearances in your book.
It's a standard go-to for any Italian, and as a dual citizen, I can't make a meal without using it. It's a law over there, and it's paprika in my house.
And it makes an appearance in another recipe you shared with us. We have it at WPR.org/Food Friday, a peri-peri dry rub. I've had peri-peri chicken. I love it. It's like, what, Afro-Portuguese, African-Portuguese combination, paprika, and a lot of other spices. Can you talk us through this rub?
Yeah, and it can be just used as a spice as well. I put it in as a rub because I love to smother things in it before I cook, but you can put it on the table almost like you would paprika or chili powder. And it's really tangy. It's got that West African life, Portuguese soul, and it's a really, really great blend that actually incidentally almost got me arrested one time.
Okay, you got to tell us that story.
Okay. During the writing of this book, I was offered a retreat barn, writing barn in Vermont at the home of the owners of Shackleton Thomas Furniture, really wonderful people that I met in Antarctica and descendants of relatives of Ernest Shackleton, who nearly discovered the South Pole. And I did a big cookout for them. I do these giant Argentine barbecues inspired by Francis Malman, who's a hero of mine. And I would say it was 9-10 hours of straight cooking, Rob, over a campfire. Argentine barbecue, meat in pits, pineapples, chickens hanging from trees over smoke. And I had just got this piri-piri blended up, and I was using it and throwing it on absolutely everything. Anything I could see, I was throwing. If someone bring out an apple pie, and I was like, come here, give me that. Anyway, I go home the next day. That was sort of the end-bang barbecue of my time there. And I'm in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and going through security. I would say it's an 8-seat plane. I'm the first one in line, and they spot me for the random. You know how they do the random checks now where they butter you up with the knob and put it in for the testing for chemicals, and the whole place goes off in like an alarm clock. And the guy's like, obviously, sir, would you mind stepping over here? We're going to search your things. And I was like, okay. He's taking out all of my things from my bag and unwrapping T-shirts and finding all of these spices, you know. And it's sort of really awkward because it's happening in front of the 7 other passengers on this plane. And it's like, what is this guy doing? There's horseradish sauce, and then finally out comes the piri-piri sauce. And he smells it and looks over at me with the most accusatory look. I smell my own hands at that point, and it smells like a firehouse, right? Because I've just been cooking. I was like, sir, I'm sorry. I was yesterday over a campfire all day long. And so they test everything. They go through each spice, and it takes, I don't know, 45 minutes. At this point, the plane's late. But eventually he lets me through, and we all get on the plane, and it was like dead silence. Finally, somebody right behind me asks, I got to ask, what is going on with your bag, you know? And so I was like, look, I'm writing this book. It's a spice book. And I thought everyone was going to be really mad because we were late, but everybody was really excited. I think I made 7 sales right there.
And you smelled great, I imagine.
And I smelled great for like 3 days. The stuff's not easy to get off, so use judiciously.
We're talking about cooking with spices with Mark C. Stevens, author of the book, Cooking with Spices, 100 recipes for blends, marinades, and sauces from around the world. You mentioned fruit there. You were throwing spices on apple pie. You've got a couple pages devoted to what spices go well with what fruits. I'm at a level with you, Mark. I don't usually put spices on my fruit. I'm weirdly allergic to cinnamon, so I don't even do that basic. Tell us some of your favorite combos.
Okay. So in going back to the Francis Malman obsession I had. I was in Argentina a couple times over the past year, and this wood fire grilling that they do over coals adds the most magical smoky flavor to fruit. It has been my half obsession in grilling over the past couple years. So pineapple is amazing, and what's amazing on pineapple is paprika. It's fantastic.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy. Put a little bit of honey and paprika mix and slather it on the pineapple, like slice it whole, like, you know, in strips and cut out the core. And as you're grilling it, honey and paprika, and it comes out amazing. And just right before it blackens, take it off. And it's like this sweet, hot, kind of spicy deliciousness. It's really amazing. The last time I did one, I bought a house here in New Orleans where I live, and I had a housewarming party, and we cut up a bunch of papaya, and we put straight chili powder on the papaya, as we were grilling it. And when I tell you it was scavenged by the crowd, I've rarely seen things be so venomously eaten as I have on that day. And then those are two just off the top of my head, but a couple from the book are cumin, nutmeg on avocados, which most people wouldn't expect. And then also anardana, which is not easy to find, but it's dried pomegranate seeds. And if you mash those up and grind them up, they go good on a lot of things. What else is good? Allspice, cumin, spicy things on lemon and citrus always go great together. And I don't know, let's say pears. Oh my God, I love pears. You're allergic to cinnamon.
Yeah, sorry, man.
Yeah, for those who aren't, it's a great pairing, but perhaps you could throw on a little bit of vanilla, maybe even just a dash of vanilla extract if you have it laying around.
Ooh, that sounds fantastic, too. We've got one more recipe you shared with us, backcountry chimichurri sauce. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Chimichurri, for those who are not in the know, is the heart and soul to me of Argentine barbecue. It's a green sauce. It's made with parsley and a whole bunch of herbs, also spices. Throw a chili in there if you like a little bit of heat, which I do for sure, and olive oil, and you get this green sauce that you put directly on steak. The steak comes off the grill. You cut it up into pieces, and you put chimi on it. And it's like a tango in your mouth. It is fantastic. And I've had it for quite some time. The time I've had it that expressed the most to me was I was backcountry hiking in Argentina and Patagonia, and we did 4 or 5 backcountry hikes, and we'd go into the mountains, and then we'd come out, and of course you're backcountry hiking, so you're taking only what you need and eating very little, sandwiches and whatnot, and then we'd come back out and just gorge on steak and chicken and not a lot of vegetables in that culinary culture. And we went to Bariloche, where we met up with this crew of Argentines, and we had been in the woods, so we wanted to host them over. So we hosted them at our guest house, and we did it up. We made chicken, and I made pasta, and we had a private chef with us, and she did the table and the arrangement, and it looked like something you could put in Food and Wine magazine. and they all loved it, and the next night they invited us over to their house in the backyard, and they did this Argentine parrilla in basically a hole in the ground where they cooked this lamb and had rolls and made empanadas and grilled them up and, of course, had steak. And they put this chimi on it and served it to us in basically on cardboard trays and passed it around. And we were like, we have done everything wrong our whole entire life. We do not know what this is the way to eat, you know, this is the way to host. And it was really funny because later on, as we became better friends with these folks, we met them in Buenos Aires later, and they confessed to us, they were like, you know, we went over to your house and you guys had just come out of the woods and you're not even from Argentina and you host.
That's great. We have to leave it there. Out of time, Mark C. Stevens, his new book is called Cooking with Spices. Find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. A time-honored cheese tradition is ending in England, and maybe it's an opportunity for Wisconsin. Thanks to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin for tweeting about this story. For over 50 years, the British village of Stilton, the birthplace of Stilton cheese, has held a cheese rolling race as part of its annual festival. You know, those big round blocks of cheese, except they weren't really rolling the cheese down the street, but wooden replicas of Stilton cheese. Now, according to the group Atlas Obscura, who we've heard from on the show, the event is going to come to an end because of a lack of funding and a lack of interest from the younger generations. Yes, English millennials are killing cheese racing, but this is clearly an opportunity for us here in Wisconsin. We make a bit of cheese in the state. We like our, you know, unusual summer festivals and observances and this and that. There's got to be a town out there. There's somebody out there listening. You've got a town. You've got a festival. You've got a cheesemaker. You just need to get a bunch of teams together and get the cheese roll race going. So make it happen. Let us know about it on Central Time if you have it set up for this summer. Keep this proud tradition of cheese racing alive. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.